Welcome to Green is Good, raising awareness of each individual's impact on the environment and helping to create a more beautiful and sustainable world. Now, here's John Shigarian, Chairman and CEO of Electronic Recyclers International, and Mike Brady.
Welcome to Green is Good, and Mike, it's so great to be here in studio with you again today.
You know, I just can't wait for this time to roll around every week, a chance for us to get together as friends and just get together with our audience and entertain, inform, and empower everybody, ourselves included, in what we can do to take better care of this beautiful earth we've been handed.
Well, Mike, we have a special edition today of Green is Good. We have two amazing guests on the front end of the show. We have John and Patricia Adams, who have co-authored the book Force for Nature. And for our listeners out there who are not familiar with John and Patricia Adams, they are two of the co-founders of the NRDC, which is probably one of the most important environmental activist groups in the entire world. So, Mike, I think our listeners have to come on back to Green is Good after this commercial break and hear John and Patricia Adams now.
If a little green is good, more is even better. Now, back to Green is Good with John Shigarian and Mike Brady.
Welcome back to Green is Good, and we are so honored today. And when I say honored, I underline the word honored, Mike. We have today with us on the line John Adams and Patricia Adams. And John is the co-founder of the NRDC, and Patricia is one of the founding directors of the NRDC, and this dates back 40 years. And just to make it real simple here, because their bios are two of the most impressive bios I've ever read in my life, and we want to get them on the line right away here. It says here, Rolling Stone magazine said, if the planet has a lawyer, it's John Adams. And I just want to say, Mike and I have started this show, and we are so really, truly honored to have you both on today because of people like you. Welcome to Green is Good, John and Patricia Adams.
Thank you. We're very happy to be here and talk to you today.
Yes, John and Mike, this is a real honor for us, and we're very, very glad that you're letting us talk about the book. So let's go to it.
And speaking of the book, they have just written, co-authored a book called Force for Nature. And I'm just going to say this. They were kind enough to send us an advanced copy, and I'm already halfway through it. And Mike, and to all our listeners out there, if you really care about the environment, and if you really want to do something about it, and if you want to find hope and see where we've come the last 40 years and where we're going to go, this is the one book to buy, and this is the one book to read during the upcoming holiday season. Force for Nature, it's called. You can find it on Amazon.com, Borders, Barnes & Noble. John and Patricia, why the book after 40 years? Share with our listeners, what compelled you to write this book?
Well, let me say that the first reason that we wrote the book is we wanted to record the 40 years of the modern environmental movement. And this marks our 40 years and the environmental movement's 40 years. So 1970 is when the first environmental laws were written. NRDC got incorporated, and at the latter end of 1970, after a long struggle, we were granted our tax exemption by the IRS. So we spent all of those early years working on the rules and regulations of the great laws that were passed 40 years ago. Second, we wanted to record the work of a lot of people who no one will remember if they weren't included in this book. These are the people who stood by us, helped us raise money, gave us the creative advice that was needed. They were giants. 40 years ago in the law profession in New York. Stephen Duggan is one. David Sive is another. James Marshall, the brother of the great Bob Marshall, is another. And Bill DeWind, who was our chairman for 17 years. These are people that we owe a great obligation to, and they rank as high to me as John Muir does to the Sierra Club.
And I just want to add that over the years, we often talked about the importance of all the people who worked together at NRDC, and I was always struck by what a team effort it was, and we were all on the same team. And I love the stories that are embedded in this book, and this book is the stories of people who did particular things to work to save our environment.
Well, let's go back.
It's a model of law, science, and economics combined with the power of citizens, people. And so we think this is a good model and that people should look at what NRDC was able to do in the 40 years and figure out how they can use our model to do things in their communities, in their regions, in their state, and I hope including in the federal.
I just want to add one. Running through this book is the theme, start small but think big. And that's what a lot of big changes were made by starting small but thinking big and continuing on forward.
Well, you know, when we talk about that, going back to the beginning, Patricia, you and John talk about starting small. You two were in a very small apartment. And
it
it's
was
hard,
a small apartment.
Hard to believe now, just all of the, 40 years later, all of the amazing work that has been done by an organization now world famous, the National Resource Defense Council, that started in your small apartment. Take us back 40 years ago to how that started.
Well, we were living in the village. We had just had our third child, and it was. We talk about one of the reasons that NRDC was started because of the real pollution that was there. The river flowed with raw sewage. The air was so dirty. We tell in the book how when the window was left open in our apartment, our baby would have soot on his forehead, you know, in the morning. That's how dirty the air was.
Wow.
And these things combined with the feeling in 1970 that things could happen. Don't forget, it was the era of the civil rights movement, early women's movement. We did feel, and we were young, that the world could be changed. And John, I think you could pick up on that.
Yeah, I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and had a reputation of caring about the outdoors, and a lot of people used to come up to our farm in the Catskills from the U.S. Attorney's Office. So when a group of people who were involved in trying to stop the desecration of Storm King Mountain, it's a famous mountain painted by the Hudson River painters, lots of pictures of it in the Metropolitan, and they, a group of folks started a big fight about that. It lasted about 10 years. But along the way, several of them came to me and said, look, we don't want to have to go through this again. We spent a lot of money here. We need an NAACP, Legal Defense Fund of the Environment, and you look like a good candidate to come and start it. And with that and a little help, we went off and started NRDC on January 2nd, 1970.
So they drafted you.
I was drafted.
Yeah, first round draft pick. How fortuitous! Let's go back just a year prior. Now in 1969, we had something that was a precursor to what just happened in the Gulf. I remember it so well, growing up and being a student down in Southern California in 1969, the Santa Barbara oil spill, which led to some great changes in legislation and a new national agency.
Yes, it did. I mean, it played a major role in the creation of EPA and a lot of the laws in California, and the Department of Interior banned drilling in that area. And we have been able, with our California allies, you know, we have two offices in California and about 100 people working there, but also with the Sierra Club and others, we've been able to keep Santa Barbara free of drilling. Been a lot of threats to get it back on there now, because the oil companies are going farther and farther to extremes to where they go to get oil.
Hmm. And before 1970, Patricia, did you and John always consider yourself environmentalists?
Well, I grew up in western North Carolina in the southern Appalachians, and my father was in the Forest Service, and I spent my youth camping and in the wilderness. His mantra was, can't you hear the wild? It's calling you. And John grew up in rural New York, in upstate New York, in the Catskill Mountains. So we both, were both great lovers of nature, and I think we became environmentalists, which was really a new word in 1970. It's when we looked around at the things that we loved, the natural world being destroyed, and that at that point we were sort of became, we were always environmentalists and loved nature, but when it became political is when we became official environmentalists.
Yeah, I couldn't back then spell environmentalist. I thought of myself as a conservationist. I just, you know, I loved the farm life that I had grown up on with, and I also was very, very concerned with the sprawl that was taking place across America. People were just moving out further and further into farmland all through New York and really everywhere. And but a group of my friends were very much involved in the Storm King case, so we knew a lot about that. I was meeting with friends of mine who were public interest lawyers in Washington, one of whom was working on the plan for the development of the Alaskan pipeline and very concerned about it coming down through the Arctic and what might happen up there. So we were being pulled a number of ways into this movement, and when this opportunity came along, it was just like, okay, let's go.
If you've just joined our show right now, we're on the line right now with John Adams and Patricia Adams, the founders of the NRDC, and they're explaining their why and how the NRDC got founded and their new book, Force for Nature, which you can buy at Amazon.com, Borders, Barnes & Noble, and all the great bookstores around you. So you start the NRDC. Share with us some of the cataclysmic moments that happened in the NRDC's early history and in the modern environmental law movement, which you are also very involved with.
You know, that is a great question because it really does cover a lot of different things. I would say Rachel Carson, the Santa Barbara oil spill, the Storm King case, there were several other major ski developments out in California, and David Brower and his great books, they were all very, very important in the building of the early environmental movement. Then we got started. We got approval to practice law as a charitable corporation in New York, the first time an organization had been approved for charitable practice of law. And the next thing that happened is we applied for a tax exemption. And the environmental laws were being passed, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, but Richard Nixon had a trick up his sleeve, and he did not want radicals bringing lawsuits. And so our tax exemption was blocked. And we then spent 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, fighting to get the tax exemption, and it was a bitter, bloody fight that cost us all of the resources we had and almost killed us off. But the one thing that it did is it made everybody who was lined up to be on the staff of NRDC, Gus Speth and John Bryson and Dick Ayers and Ed Strobain, all great lawyers, they were looking for an opportunity, if we ever got this tax exemption, to really leave a mark. So the next thing that happened, we got the tax exemption, and that cleared up a cloud for a lot of organizations around the country. Very shortly thereafter, we watched the cases, and in the Storm King case, citizens were given the right to sue, even if they didn't have an economic interest in the outcome. That was a very, very important ruling. And we then saw the power of our members and the role that a membership, even if it was small, could play in cases. We used our memberships right from the beginning to send out alerts about the things we were working on, and that made a huge difference. I would say that the early laws that were passed, NEPA, requiring planning and thought to determine whether the course of action you were taking was the best course of action for the environment. Everyone has to think of that as really one of the most important ideas. Unfortunately, people don't follow that rule as much as they should because there have been exemptions and so on that have taken place. But the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act gave citizens the right to enforce those laws. Can you imagine what that meant?
Wow.
It meant that NRDC could bring as many as 500 lawsuits against polluters.
Wow.
And then I would just say one of the other major events that unified the environmental movement was the Protecting the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And that is, you know, it's something that we have all united behind as just one of the things that we're going to do. Those are just a few of the actions, and there are many others that we could talk about.
Got it. You know, until I read your book, John and Patricia, I didn't really even realize that the NRDC truly began as a law firm and has obviously involved in that you're involved with, you know, policy, science, business. and law. So explain a little bit, you know, how that evolution really happened. And we're going to then talk a little bit about the business aspects that are now really, really taking over now in many ways with regards to the movement and how the whole green revolution has evolved over the last 40 years. Patricia, do you want to share some of that with us?
Well, I think the backbone of NRDC has always been litigation, and as you say, it started out as a law firm. And the strength of our litigation arm is always there. It helps go to the table for negotiations a lot easier. And but as you said, over the years, a lot of different forces have been brought to bear. And one thing about NRDC over the years, in the environmental world, even when you do win, it can take years to implement court decisions or acts or to be watchdogs for NEPA. In fact, the EPA said in the early years of NRDC that the lawyers here were like American patriots and revolutionaries who were behind every tree. And often EPA is happy that it has NRDC to help sort of police and be ever vigilant looking at the various cases.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, again, this is a terrific question because it really takes you through the whole movement when you ask about law and then science and now economics. When we started, there were six of us.
Wow.
And when we finished, we've got 400 plus. So very early on, when people were working on the health issues of the Clean Air Act and the science issues of clean water and toxic chemicals, it became absolutely imperative that we have the kinds of trained people who could, using their master's or doctorate degrees, speak for us. So we began a program of really public interest science. Not easy to do because most scientists look to the future of somehow being connected to science and they wanted to make sure that their reputation was intact and they didn't speak outside of their field. And what we were looking for were Renaissance scientists. We wanted people who would look at the issues that we were working on and going to work on and tell us, were we in the right direction or the wrong direction? And we didn't want them to be hobbled by the so-called rules of the science industry. So we added scientists, and they have become incredible resources for us. They trained our lawyers to be scientists. And I would say that the credit for this goes to a scientist named George Woodwell, who was at the Woods Hole Research Center. And a great man. This is one of the people who identified climate as an early peril and has continued to lead the country in thinking about what we should do and how we should deal with this very, very important issue. But he was somebody that regularly took on the science industry if they were peddling something that wasn't really good for the public health or for our world, and so we tried to follow that. And then, so that by the time we were in the business 10 years, we had 4 or 5 scientists, and then we started adding people from the Yale School of the Environment and the Duke School and Berkeley School of Energy. In fact, all of our early energy people came out of the Berkeley School, really from under John Holdren. So that was how we built up the various trades at NRDC.
Could I just tell a short story that
Sure.
really about scientists? These were Laurie Mott and Al Meyerhoff in California asking a very simple question. What kind of toxics and pesticides are in the market when you get a bag of groceries? And they actually took them to test them to see what they and their children were eating, and they found they were still full of DDT and other pesticides that had been outlawed for years. And this started a whole investigation about the food industry and the toxics and pesticides used, which resulted in a very big case for NRDC in the 1980s, which was getting rid of Alar on apples that are used so much for young toddlers and children, apple juice and things like that, to make their diet safer. So again, it was asking just a question about what are we eating that led to these big cases that NRDC has taken on.
Our guests today, John and Patricia Adams, founding members of the NRDC. And, you know, John, Patricia, what you've really done, and I love the term that you use, John, Renaissance scientists. What you've done is you have increased your depth on the bench, starting out not just with attorneys, but then getting scientists involved and economists as well. You are connecting the dots. Everything is connected to everything else, and that really is what the definition of environment is. So it really makes so much sense what you did from the beginning to ask the questions, the big questions. How does this relate? How does this connect? Putting the puzzle together.
You're absolutely right. That's what it is.
And so now, with regards to, now you went from six committed people to 400, you were saying, John, now. And so many of the people have been there the whole duration. You know, Mike and I are so honored and lucky to not only have you and Patricia today on the show, but we've had many members from the NRDC appear on the show before. And as we say to them before they come on, you have the deepest bench in the whole industry. You really are the leading organization. As Robert Redford said, 40 years later, many people, myself included, regard the NRDC as possibly the most effective environmental organization on the planet. So what is your secret sauce? You know, many companies and many organizations start small, but they can never scale. So now, as you've scaled, how would you account, you know, the longevity and the true collaborative spirit that your members and colleagues have?
Well, I guess I would start off by saying that my experience at the U.S. Attorney's Office taught me that young people can do a lot. You know, that's a place where young people come in, get training, and then go on to a legal career or become a judge. And it was a great experience. I thought it was wonderful. It was a collaborative way of dealing with issues. Everybody helped everybody else. And so when I started NRDC, my goal was to have a place where we all worked together to figure out what the most important issues were and how we were going to do it, and that it was going to be on the model of a family. I don't mean it that exactly like it was a family,
right,
but I wanted people who liked each other, trusted each other, worked together with each other. And then Patricia and I worked to create an ambiance at outside of NRDC where people could come to our home. We had all of our picnics up there. We treated people well. We looked for ways to make people feel good. We made it clear we wouldn't put up with a lot of people lording over others depending on what position they held at NRDC. And I really believe the model of hiring really, really talented people, putting them in a good atmosphere and a good place, and letting them do their work unless they needed help. But really, when you were the kinds of people we have hired, you know who they are: David Hawkins, Ralph Cavanna, David Goldstein, you know, just go through the people who have come and worked at NRDC. Sarah Chases, who's been with us for 38 years working on oceans. Francis Beinecke, who's been with NRDC for 35 years, working on a range of issues, including the oceans issues, and then really working on the management of NRDC. These are people who feel that everybody in the institution is their friend. They have an obligation to them, and we have an obligation to each other, and I think that's why people stay.
I will just add to that, being with John all these years, John's philosophy is hire the best people who are committed to the environment and then give them free rein, but always back them up and be supportive. And I think that created a very good atmosphere within the whole office and that sense of family, as John talked about earlier.
And Patricia, I love what you shared with our listeners earlier. Start small and think big, and that's actually what you've done. Unfortunately, we're down to the last minute and a half here, and I'd like you both to share any last thoughts you have with our listeners before we leave and sign off and tell our listeners again to buy your amazing and wonderful book, Force for Nature. Any last thoughts on the future of the NRDC, the future of John and Patricia Adams, and where this whole movement is going from here on in?
I'll just quickly say, and then let John finish up, that I think that the generation coming now is aware of what's happening with our environment today. We're going to the ends of the earth in extremes now to get fossil fuels, but I have great belief that there will solutions will be found.
Yeah, I think that I would say there's one point that we haven't made, and that's the power of the membership. We have 1,200,000 close to 300,000 members in e-activists, members of E2, the folks in that help us from Hollywood to New York to Boston. These are great people who are committed to help us achieve our goals. We've expanded out, and I look at the 75 people at NRDC who are working on energy and energy efficiency, and I know that we're going to get where we have to go. It's going to take a little bit longer, but we'll get there.
That is so great, and I want to just thank you both for your time today. You know, Force for Nature, John and Patricia have just written, and if you can only buy one book, and you're only going to read one book, upload it on your Kindle, your iPad, buy it on Amazon.com, or go down to Borders, Barnes & Noble, or your local bookstore. Force for Nature. Patricia and John, for Mike and I, this is exactly why we started this show. I mean, to have both of you on today is truly the reason we do what we do here at Green is Good. And you are just both inspirational visionaries that have shared your message of hope today. And we just want to thank you and just say that you are both living proof that green is good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that wonderful statement.
If a little green is good, more is even better. Now, back to Green is Good with John Shigarian and Mike Brady.
Welcome back to Green is Good, Mike. Patricia and John Adams are truly a force for nature, and I hope all our listeners buy their new book.
You know, I was really inspired talking to John and Patricia, but we have got a great back half of Green is Good today.
Dave Stangus, the Vice President, CSR and Sustainability from Campbell's Soup, is coming on next after this commercial. Come on back to Green is Good.
If a little green is good, more is even better. Now, back to Green is Good with John Shigarian and Mike Brady.
Welcome back to Green is Good, and we're so honored today to have Dave Stangus on, who's the Vice President of CSR and Corporate Sustainability for Campbell's Soup. Dave, welcome to Green is Good.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You know, if I took the time to read your bio, we'd take half the show, and that's not the purpose. But, Dave, you were doing this. You were green, and you were leading this movement way before it became cool to be green. You were at Intel for 12 years, already heading up their CSR program. Can you share a little bit about your history and how you got involved and why you got involved with the whole green and corporate responsibility movement?
Sure. It's there were very few people doing this back in the, I would say, late 90s. My background is in the environmental health and safety arena, and that's basically what I was hired to do at Intel Corporation. I worked in Arizona in a corporate group, and after about a year, I was asked to try to take a broader role looking at external affairs in environmental health and safety. And all of a sudden, kind of the doors opened up. It was really clear to see what socially responsible investors were asking about, the issues that were in the press. The questions moved from green to diversity and ethics and just good corporate citizenship around the world. So we took a couple years and really worked hard to create this function at that company.
Right.
And Intel's done great work since then, and we tried to build really a system to manage it. But, you know, we started small there, and it's grown over the years. And I felt good when I was able to leave and knowing that it would continue. And it was a great opportunity to come and start a similar program over here at Campbell.
That is so great. And, you know, for our listeners out there, I want to also share with you one of the most important things from your bio, that you were named one of the 100 most influential people in business ethics by Ethisphere magazine. And that in this day and age, in this post-Enron, post-economic collapse era that we live in, to have somebody like you pushing the movement forward. It's an honor to have you here today, and that's a great award. I want to just talk about something, though, that a lot of our listeners email us and call us about, and it's the issue of being a capitalist and also a tree hugger and how to merge these two movements together. You know, you have a great quote here that we picked up online. When I was hired at Campbell at my first board meeting, I told them they didn't hire a tree hugger. I wasn't going to go out and plant trees and clean up the streets. They hired a capitalist, but I was going to go and try to help them become a better company and make money. And you know, that's what we do here at Green is Good. We share these great stories that those can go hand in hand. Dave, you want to talk a little bit about that and talk about what your evolution has looked like at Campbell's?
Sure. Yeah, it's a big point to make that these aren't exclusive properties. I think you can be My point to the Campbell board is they didn't know who I was. I was an unknown entity to them.
Right.
And the board is made up of a bunch of major share owners, family members that are very proud of the brand, and a bunch of ex-CEOs. And I wanted to make sure they understood where I was coming from to create this strategy. I was asking for a lot in terms of their buy-in and trust. And I wanted them, and it's always been my premise to try to build CSR and sustainability strategies that really work for the employees, really work for the executives, are translatable to the external world, but that make the company better, that make them, you know, allows them to make quicker decisions, drives innovation, builds employee engagement, and makes a social impact in the community and lowers the, reduces the environmental footprint. I wanted them to know, and I think that worked with them, but and they continue to, you know, we continue to build trust and grow that program. But the main thing is that it's not one or the other. I'm the same person that's out volunteering in the community and working to drive everything I can in the environment, but I try to do it for a business reason, and I try to, I think the biggest shift you've seen in the last decade is instead of people like me trying to convince everybody to be sustainability professionals, we've learned that our job is to make them better at what they do by using tools of sustainability and CSR so that the supply chain people can be better supply chain people and the HR, human resources people, can be better at what they do in terms of staffing and recruiting.
Got it.
So we're helping them with a whole other set of tools and making better decisions, and that's really the goal for the company.
Well, you know, for our listeners out there that have their iPad or their laptop or some other type of internet device open right now, Campbell Soup, and Mike, you, I think you have it open right now. You guys have an amazing site, campbellsoup.com, and there's a whole section there, many sections, with regards to CSR and you know, nourishing the planet, nourishing employees. I mean, some of the statistics here, what you're accomplishing over there, Dave, are amazing, such as, well, I'm here on the nourishing the planet side. You've eliminated, over the past year, more than 3.5 million pounds of steel and 1 million pounds of fiber. You're recycled more than 84% of the waste that's been generated. Talk a little bit about all these different segments and what sustainability and CSR looks like now than it did back when you started this whole movement over at Intel.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot more pointed in terms of seeing numbers and results like this. That, you know, Campbell is a company that's been around for more than 140 years, and that it's a great company. People know the brand. They know the sub-brands of Pepperidge Farm and V8 and Pace and Prego, and they've always been doing good work, but they had difficulty kind of, I think, envisioning what success looked like in terms of sustainability. So what we did, and the CEO even challenged me on this, was to create a 10-year agenda. What is it we're going to stand for? What is it we're going to try to drive? And we came up with a lot of baseline work and metrics and some strategies around what we're doing in the environment, what we're doing in the community, what we're doing in the marketplace, and what we're doing in the workplace. And we built it into our compensation systems, into our, you know, performance reviews, into just the way we talk. The Campbell annual report just came out last week or the week before, the financial report, and it sounds a lot like my report. So there's an alignment, some integration in terms of the way we communicate. But the environmental targets are really ways so that people can come to work every day and know what they should be focused on. Our packaging engineers have actually kind of stretched this goal. They're willing to try to take out 100 million pounds of packaging.
Wow.
Over the next decade. And we're trying to really take the whole environmental footprint of our entire product portfolio and cut it in half over the next decade to use half as much water per whatever we manufacture, soup, crackers, biscuits, and same amount or same cut in terms of emission of greenhouse gases.
Dave, and how long when did you start at Campbell's?
I've been here just a little over 2 years.
Wow.
So I haven't been on the ground long at Campbell. I came in Labor Day 2008. I did my first full-blown strategic plan for the executives and the board of directors within the first couple months that I was there. So they put me to work right away. And we've been, you know, running fast ever since I got there. But we have to say we're really still at the beginning of this journey. There's a lot we need to do. There's a lot of great things going on at other companies and other sectors that we're learning from. And we're trying to help our suppliers and some smaller companies and even some of our customers advance their strategies as we work on this.
Well, you know, David, just looking at your corporate mission statement just, I think, gives our listeners a really good idea about how all-encompassing Campbell's vision towards the future is. And you just joined the company, as you mentioned, a couple of years ago. But the mission statement, which is not much older with a company than your employment there, together, We will build the world's most extraordinary food company by nourishing people's lives everywhere, every day.
And that word, that first word, together, is the thing we say is the most important inside of our company. And it's another reason we built the CSR strategy. The other thing I told the executives when I came is I'm not here to reinvent your mission or create a new set of strategies for the company. I'm here to build something that is integral to the way you've done business for years, but kind of amplifies your ability to do more, to be better in the community, to be better in the marketplace. And that's why we framed, you know, this nourishing concept across these pillars, and we built systems to bring every employee. The other, you know, kind of the workplace destination goal is that every single employee has a role in these strategies going forward. They don't have to guess what their role is in terms of sustainability. They know what to do. It's part of their performance objectives.
That is great. Now, it's interesting what you just said. You know, a couple things that themes that we've heard before, that this is really not an overnight type of situation. This is a process, and you've started implementing this 10-year process, and you're 2 years into it. Dave, one other thing you shared, that you're learning from others and others are learning from you. You have a unique position, the vice president of CSR and sustainability for Campbell Soup. 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't a typical position in corporate America. And are you working, and is there a working group among high-level leaders with that similar position across corporate America now where you guys all share best practices?
It's amazing what has transpired over the last 10 years. When I was putting together the case for Intel to try to convince Intel to move in this space, I think I found one other person.
Wow.
And he's still in that job, a great guy named Bob Langert over at McDonald's.
Wow.
But that was it. Over the last 10 years, there has been an explosion of people like me. Almost every Fortune 500 company not only has maybe one like me here at Campbell,
right,
maybe teams, maybe 10, maybe 20, maybe as small as three. But you can't find a company with a strong brand reputation, a good consumer promise, without somebody like me working around. And if you don't, there's people like me helping you as another company set it up. I mean, I don't view these things as competitive. In certain areas, that, you know, the real critical decisions that affect the marketplace, I may not share, but I'm always having conversations with other companies about how to set up strategies. We share information all the time. There are more meetings than we can go to every day.
Wow.
Where there are people like me sharing this information. We, you know, I have to turn down, and it's not just me, everybody
right.
in this space has to turn down probably more opportunities to engage than we have time to go to.
That's wonderful. So really there is a best practice just sharing among the folks that are running corporate America in the CSR space.
Yeah, I mean, every week I'm at meetings where a couple weeks ago I was at a meeting in Wisconsin, and it was across sector, not just in the food and beverage sector, where
That's
we're
great.
Sharing great ideas and we're kind of borrowing and sharing what we do best, and other companies are picking up on it. I was at a meeting just last week with a bunch of executives like me in our sector, and we're talking about what's going on at the Trade Association, what's going on internationally, what are we doing with our customers, how are we strengthening our supply chain. So it's intra-sector, it's outside of the sector, it's across the whole business chain now.
So now you're into this for 2 years. I'm reading another great stat from your wonderful website, campbellsoup.com, for our listeners out there that want to go and read all the great things that Campbell's is doing. And as Dave pointed out earlier, that also has to do with Pepperidge Farm, V8, Pace, Prego, Swanson, all their great legacy brands that are comfort food to all of us here across the United States. But you, for instance, over the last year, you guys have invested more than $6 million in environmental sustainability projects. Now that you're there 2 years and really are really up to it in your armpits and beyond, what's going on at the corporate board level? What does the board say now, and how has the buy-in been at your at the board level?
It's been great. I've done two full-blown board presentations each year. We did a full kind of strategy presentation last year. This past year, I did one that was much more focused on issues and trends in the marketplace and how they're driving behavior and performance in high-level business and then within our sector. So what we're doing is we're really bringing them up the knowledge curve in terms of strategic corporate social responsibility and sustainability, because they want to know, they're number one, they're really proud of the company. So they want to understand, this why they have, why is it there, and what does it mean in terms of equity in the marketplace, and how can they leverage it to be better?
Right.
And they also want to understand, you know, how it's being managed in their company, because they're looking at financial issues and human resource issues and expanding to emerging markets, and they want to see this fitting in. They don't want to see it as some standalone process that's off on the side that's just looking to get credit. It's about how do you make all of these other parts of the business better. And we've done updates periodically with them, and we do these full-blown, you know, kind of hour-long education sessions with them. And it's been great. They've been a great board. There's, like I said, a bunch of business people on there and a bunch of people that are really proud of the company. And it makes a difference. And we're going to continue to account. You mentioned the investment that we've made in environmental sustainability projects.
Sure.
We're going to continue to account for some of these numeric issues where we have direct financial inputs.
Well,
and we can show and communicate both to our board and to the external world.
Well, obviously, they have to be proud of you, because here over the past year, it says Campbell Soup has been named to the Dow Jones Sustainability Index and Corporate Responsibility Magazine's 100 Best Corporate Citizens list. So again, your efforts and their efforts, and as you said, together, you are making a difference and making really great strides towards your goals.
Yeah, and it's a good point on, you know, we're not doing this for the recognition, but the recognition's great to have. And the two that you mentioned,
yeah,
the Dow Jones Sustainability Index and the Best Corporate Citizens list, have really interesting methodologies behind them that companies like Campbell, I've used them for years over Intel and now Campbell,
as
a way to drive improvement and to strengthen programs. But small, medium companies, any company on the planet can use these tools to continue to look for ways to continue to drive continuous improvement.
You know, go ahead.
There is no end point. Whenever we see the finish line, it's just a mirage. The bar keeps getting higher every year. We're all running at it, and we're, you know, it's a marathon. It's kind of a sprint marathon, and we know it. The people that are in my roles at other companies know we're in this for the long haul, and we'll be doing it as long as we're working here.
Well, that's, you know, you bring up a great point. So we'll go back to the corporate board issue with regards to your amazing CSR expertise, because truly you're one of the founders of this whole movement then on a corporate level. Is this going to be typical, and is this going to be much like the financial auditing Sarbanes-Oxley standards? Are boards going to look at these metrics as important as financial and auditing standards that are out there now?
Yeah, I think there's a couple dynamics to this. Several companies have, you know, they may not have formal presentations like I have with my board, or this kind of, you know, I have a very interactive relationship, but some companies actually have committees that are chartered to look at environmental sustainability as part of their, you know, their accountabilities at the board. You're going to see that more going forward. The other thing I think you're going to see, just now that we have, you know, we have accounting experts, we have financial experts on boards, I think you're going to start to see, you know, corporate social responsibility or sustainability experts on boards that give advice to the board, that challenge the in-house expertise and drive it even more. You know, if a company is coming out with a new product or is changing its financials, it will get challenged at the board to make better decisions and to try to justify what it's doing. I think you're going to see that in the corporate responsibility space as well. But boards are getting it. They're getting more training, and companies are actually starting to figure out ways to build this into the board cycle.
Got it. And from Campbell's point of view, how did they, when you go back and look at the genesis of them getting involved here, how did they come and find you, and why did they do that? Was that at the board level? Was that, were they hearing that from their consumers out there? What was the impetus for them to go create this position, you know, when it didn't exist before?
Well, they have, I mean, one of the reasons I came to is they have an extraordinary leadership team. So their set of corporate officers, the CEO, the executive team that's running the business, they were not toying around with, that's the wrong term, but they were figuring out how this would work. They had done a bunch of external scanning. They had taken a look at other reports and other companies that they thought were, you know, highly reputable. They saw this trend coming. They tried to get their hands around it and figure out how can we organize it. You know, how do we put the people and resources together? They spent a long time publishing their first report, which was, you know, before the one you're looking at today. It was a printed version, very good first report. It was all about who they are as a company. But going through that process, you know, justifying why they needed to put effort into this program, they had conversations at the board, at the CEO level. It was also clear to them that they didn't have the competencies in-house to create a world-class program. They know they wanted it. They knew the pieces that they wanted to have in that program. They weren't exactly sure where it would go in the organization. But the biggest thing, I think, is they didn't know what success actually looked like for Campbell Soup. So I think their goal was to try to find, you know, they didn't just come to me. I'm sure they interviewed a bunch of people and tried to find the best that they could and the best fit. But they wanted to find people that had experience taking a program from scratch and building it to world class, and knew how to find success and point people in that direction. And I think that was really what they were looking for. And they realized it after going through, you know, probably 2 years of scoping and communicating and sharing best practices inside the company.
Well, we're here, for our listeners who just joined us, we're here on the line at Green is Good with Dave Stangas, who is the Vice President of CSR and Sustainability at Campbell Soup, one of the greatest brands to ever be born here in the United States and that exists around the world right now. Dave, you know, one of the things you just said, you've started now two programs from scratch. And that's unbelievable. And so what is, we get a lot of emails here from across, actually across the planet, but especially across the United States. And people want to know, what is the biggest obstacle to starting this at their company? Does it matter that the company is as large as Walmart or as small as an upstart? Or how do you go about starting this? And how does this really work?
Well, there's tons of obstacles. There really are challenges every day. I think if you look at it, my suggestion when I talk to companies is, number one, you know, really do an assessment of where they sit, where they stand, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are internally and externally. Look at it as a business strategy. If you're going to kind of, you know, execute on going to a new market, launching a new product line, consider this the same thing. It's not just a bunch of activities over on the side. Do a full situation assessment. Figure out what it is you're going to stand for as a company. What are your communication plans? What are your metrics going to be? How are you going to get internal enlistment and buy-in? How are you going to develop a communication plan that everybody's going to understand both inside and outside? That sets up a, you know, basically a domino effect in terms of resources and staffing. And it's still scary and it's still daunting, but if you take a step-by-step approach at developing a strategy to help the business be better, not just translating what we're doing today so it sounds good, that's really the goal. And, again, getting over... If you wait until it's perfect before you take your first step, or your first report, you'll never get there. It's really just starting to take steps, realizing that you're never at the end, and trying to drive improvements each year, annually, whatever it is. If your strategic planning cycle is annually or every 3 years, build it into the system. That's really the goal. And the smallest company can do it.
That's hopeful. Well, for our listeners out there, you could go to CampbellSoup.com and see all the amazing things Dave and his team is doing. One of the great pages here is called Nourishing Our Consumers, and Mike and I were looking at that earlier today, and Mike's on the site right now, but I actually printed it off, and I just love how you guys have evolved your great brands that, you know, I remember growing up with and I still eat. Over the past year, you offer 90 of your soups at healthy sodium levels, including your condensed tomato soup. You've joined the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation to help reduce obesity. I mean, really, like you said, you've made this, as you said earlier, Dave, you're underlining, and Campbell's is underlining the word together.
Yeah, people look for their food to do everything these days. So this, we have one of the best portfolios from a health and wellness perspective. Yet we had challenges in terms of communicating what that meant to the consumer. You know, I want a consumer over the next 10 years to go in the store and know every product we make is the best that it can be for them. They don't even have to read the back of the label. That's kind of my goal.
That's great.
So that there's a choice for people that are looking for something to feed their kids. There's one for them. There's one for the rest of their family. There's, you know, maybe snacks. There's great food all times of the day, juices. And getting the messaging and the facts and being authentic about what we have in terms of products for people in the marketplace today that are affordable, that, you know, close nutrition gaps, is really important. We still have a lot of work to do in this space. We're working on it day in and day out, both in terms of innovation and research and development, as well as communication to the consumer and to our customers. There's a lot of work to do here, but I really think it's critical to our success in the 21st century, and I think that's the conversation I had inside the company to try to continue to get the focus on it. They've been focused on it for years, too. It's where do we take it?
You know, Dave, we're down to the last minute and a half, and we a lot of times we get a lot of students from around the United States. After your show airs, there's going to be a lot of people reaching out to us, and what happens is the are the people out there want to know how to become the next Dave Stangus. Well, how is that? William, what is the process? What's the evolution, and where is this going? Because now so many schools, so many universities have environmental health and safety programs. They have CSR programs. What if for the kids out there, for the youth of America that want to now become part of the green revolution and the solution, what advice do you have, and what last pearls or wisdoms do you have for our listeners out there?
Sure. I mean, the main thing here is they actually have more opportunity today than we did 10 years ago. I mean, not only do these single positions exist, vice president of CSR or sustainability, but the really innovative companies, the forward-thinking companies, are trying to build this into everything they're doing. So what I'm telling students and professors, because I don't want a professor to train, you know, 1,000 students to go out and get the one job that isn't there tomorrow.
Right.
But to really think about what is it they do best. Are they best at finance? Are they best at materials or packaging or optimizing logistics and supply chains? If you can take what you do best, take it to an organization or an agency, a federal environmental agency or a nonprofit, there's going to be more and more ways to bring sustainability into the workplace in every job. So we have finance people working on it now. We have advertising people working in sustainability. We have, you know, packaging engineers that didn't go to school for sustainability, but that's what they're doing today. There's just a lot more. Everybody needs to change, I think, the way they think a little bit about it and not look at just the one role to change a company, but how, if I don't have that one role, how else can I play and make a difference every day at a company? That's really what students want. They want to take their passion now and take it to work and not just hide it in the desk drawer. They want to live it.
Got it.
And that's what leading companies are starting to figure out, is they've got to give everybody the outlet and in a strategic way to help the company be better.
Well, well said. And we're so, Mike and I just want to thank you today for your time today, Dave. You really laid it out clearly, and we're so lucky to have you running the CSR and sustainability program at Campbell's, one of the great brands to ever be born here in this country. I just want to thank you again, and we're going to have you come back again one day and tell us how the process is going at Campbell's. You are really an inspirational leader and are truly living proof, Dave Stangus, that green is good.
Thank you, guys. It's been great. A lot of fun.
This program will be available for downloading in a couple of days from our station's website, Keyword Podcast. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Green is Good.